You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 16th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
On this date in 1994, Comet Shoemaker Levy 9 collided with Jupiter.
Ooh, cool.
And the impacts continued for several days until July 22nd.
That was a cool event.
That was remarkable. That was remarkable stuff.
What was the impact they hit Jupiter with? Was thousands of times the impact of like the Hiroshima bomb? Pretty nasty.
I'm sure it was something like that.
Something like that. But Jupiter is good that way. Jupiter, you know, sucks up all those comets if they don't hit us.
Left that black scar on the surface of Jupiter, which I don't think anybody really expected that to happen. So they were. It was incredible.
Did you guys know that the eye of Jupiter is about the size of the Earth?
Yes, I did know that.
Everybody knows that.
Yep. Oh, come on, guys. At least act a little impressed.
Did you know that the picture that you see of Jupiter is...
upside down. Yep, yeah. We know that. Get with it.
All right,
we're about to have a nerd off.
Did you know your eye turns things upside down and
your brain swaps
yes.
it back
That's
up?
That's right, yes.
Yes.
So therefore, is Jupiter really right side up and we're just seeing it upside down?
Next.
We have an interview coming up, another TAM interview, this one with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Woo-hoo. Big fan.
Yes. Excellent.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. His talk at TAM was excellent.
It was stellar.
It was called Brain Droppings.
Stellar.
Yeah, it was good.
I thought it was out of this world.
It was cool.
But first, some news
item. It was astronomical.
It was
first
stellar.
News item has a bit of an astronomy theme to it as well. Dallas County officials spar over the black hole comment.
This
is just a bit of ridiculous funniness. The commissioner, Kenneth Mayfield, who is white, said it seemed that Central Collections, quote-unquote, has become a black hole because paperwork reportedly has become lost in the office. Commissioner John Wiley Price, who is black, interrupted him with a loud, "Excuse me," and then corrected his colleague, saying that his office had become a white hole. So apparently, Commissioner Price took the black hole comment as a racial slur, apparently not knowing what a black hole is.
Wow.
Or not even that. You don't have to know what a black hole is. You just know what the colloquial expression means.
Yeah.
And he obviously didn't know that either.
Well, wait. You can't assume that he didn't know either of those things because some people are that uptight. Like, the term black hole is no longer acceptable to this person. That's how I read it.
I think we assume ignorance because there's just, you can't have a problem with the expression black hole because that means you then really should have expression with blacklist, black male, and all the other expressions with black in it. So I'm just assuming that he's just stupid.
Well, when in doubt, scientifically illiterate at least. Yeah. And he also said, you know, using the term white hole, well, that would be something that would eject paperwork from it, producing more paperwork, not something that would cause it to disappear.
It would have been so much cooler if he called him a white dwarf. That would have shown that he knew what
exactly.
was going on and also gave him a cosmic slam.
I wonder if the American Indians are upset at the term red giant.
Oh, God, right.
Here we go.
I mean, you can take this to an absurd extreme. But
yeah, that's my point.
It's already to the absurd extreme.
It is. You can't that's even satire it. But the interesting thing is that this also present at the meeting, Judge Thomas Jones, who's also black, demanded an apology from Mayfield. So he also didn't get the scientific reference of a black hole.
Now, isn't that incredible? No. Three lawyers in a room and two out of the three have no clue what a black hole is. That is,
you know, we're moving
pathetic.
Backwards, guys. We're not moving forward.
The cool thing is, though, he refused to apologize.
Good. We are moving back. Sure? The universe is expanding.
Actually, the news items get worse and worse from there. The next one I wanted to talk about, it was kind of a slow science news story.
It was.
We got some, I don't know if it's the summer slowdown. I don't know. No one's in the lab publishing research. I don't know what it is. But we have a few funny items. The next one has to do with P.Z. Myers, the blogger who blogs for Faringula. P.Z. Myers, in addition to doing a science blog, Faringula also is an atheist blog, and also he you know, does not shy away from expressing his political opinions on that blog. So it's really his personal blog where he talks about a bunch of different issues, including his atheism.
What happened was it started when this kid in Florida went into a Catholic church and took communion, and he didn't swallow the wafer. Like, supposedly the Catholic priest turns this cracker into Jesus, and you actually eat the flesh of Jesus. Like, they actually believe that the wafer turns into flesh, which is really gross, but set that aside for a second. So the kid takes the cracker outside of the church to go show his friend, and the Catholics freak out over it. First, they try to keep him from leaving, and he runs away, and then it turns into this big uproar where people are sending him nasty letters, and Catholics are up in arms. Not all Catholics, you know, I think that most Catholics understand that it's really not that big of a deal. But there's a certain subset of the hardcore Catholics who were not having anything of this, and including Bill Donahue of, I believe it's called the Catholic League. He kind of freaked out about the whole thing. So PZ steps in and reports on the story and happens to say that he thinks it's all a bunch of crap, that people are coming down too hard on this kid. Supposedly there were death threats against the kid, all that.
They called it a hate crime. You know, he objected to the characterizing this as a hate crime.
Right. And yeah. PZ said, you know what? It's a fracking cracker. As PZ, I would never say the word fracking, but I'm using his words. It's a fracking cracker.
A fracking is perfectly cromulent. I mean, that's right out of don't, you know, Battlestar Galactica. I mean, you know.
No,
it's Battlestar Galactica lingo. I love that.
Oh, okay, nerd. So I prefer smegging, okay? It's
smegging?
A smegging cracker. So that's Red Dwarf, by the way.
Okay.
I just out-nerded you, just in case you didn't know. So PZ says, you know, it's just a cracker, let it go. In fact, PZ says, if anybody out there wants to get another Eucharist host cracker thing and send it to him, he will personally desecrate it in the manner of his choosing. So, you know, and that's
and for
standard.
Some strange reason, the Catholics took offense at that.
Yeah, I don't know why, but Bill Whatever Donahue to- sent his minions to not only pepper PZ with emails, but to also write to PZ's employer. He is a professor for a university, and try to get him fired. And so people went on and they flooded the university with these angry emails, and then also sent actual death threats to PZ over a cracker. It was pure insanity. So wait, but it gets better. PZ took a few of the worst death threats, and in order to discourage other death threats from coming in, he posted them to the blog, copy-paste, complete with email address and full headers. Okay? So one of the death threats came from an email address that was so-and-so at 1-800-Flowers.com. And so immediately people are commenting on this post. Could it really be somebody who works for 1-800-Flowers who's using their work email to send a death threat? They check the IP numbers, and yes, it actually came from the computer of a 1-800-Flowers employee. People start sending that person emails and then also notifying the IT department at 1-800-Flowers. Well, that person was found. It was a female employee, which surprised a lot of people because of the language, including the C word and others. And that employee was fired. Shortly thereafter, that employee's husband stepped forward to say that it was actually him using his wife's computer to send PZ a death threat. And you know what? It's PZ's fault that the wife got fired. And that's where we are right now.
Perfect.
The whole affair is officially a kerfuffle.
It's a cracker kerfuffle.
Cracker kerfuffle. It absolutely is. Yes. It was a to-do at the beginning, but it's beyond
upgraded.
That now. Upgraded
to
a kerfuffle.
Upgraded to kerfuffle. Mm-hmm.
It's not a holy hubbub or...
A hubbub?
No, but we are quickly approaching melee.
Melee.
Mm-hmm.
So... Couple things I wanted to note about this. When Donahue was on the campaign to get PZ fired, his argument was that PZ's blog is accessible from his work computer. Hello? It's on the internet!
I think you mean that it was linked from the university's website, you mean?
No, he said it was his statement says accessible from.
Weird.
I mean, if he was referring to the fact that there was a link from somewhere, he didn't. He wasn't even that specific. Maybe he was referring to that, but
I think that's what he meant, because part of the angry letters were to encourage the university to stop linking to PZ's blog from the university website.
That may be true, but his argument was that he should be fired because he was using somehow official university computer to access the web, his blog. His blog is on Science Blogs. It's not on the university website. It's not hosted by the university. I mean, you know, firing somebody because it links to another site, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, of course, this all becomes a question of freedom of speech. I have no problem with anyone criticizing PZ for doing what he's doing. PZ has a right to say whatever he wants to say. It's his blog. He could use it to express whatever opinions he wishes. People have a right to criticize him for that on their own venues. But they tried to essentially make the point that PZ doesn't have the right to do what he did or to criticize Catholic beliefs. And this comes up occasionally. Essentially, the premise is that some religionists use, and the recent cartoon incident with the Muslims, this came up as well, cartoons depicting Muhammad, is that other people, in fact, all other people, must respect those things that they deem to be sacred. That's where I think that's the false premise I think they're coming from. Saying, all right, you think that's sacred, so you can revere it. You could, you know, do whatever you think is appropriate, but you can't demand that other people behave as if it's sacred. Out of this notion that's necessary in order for you to have your religious freedom. So I think that's sort of the logical fallacy, false premise that they're proceeding from. You know, that's free speech.
Yeah, how about the First Amendment?
You know, burning a flag, if it's part of political speech, that's protected free speech. You know, desecrating a wafer, if that's part of your political free speech, you have the right to do that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, they gave him the cracker, and he didn't sign anything saying, you know, I will eat the cracker on your premises and not hold it hostage. I mean, it's all the whole thing.
Beyond
it's
ridiculous.
Just, it's so ridiculous. It blows my mind that people could actually threaten the life or even just the livelihood of another person over a cracker.
Yeah. And the most absurd thing is that it draws the most a ridiculous negative attention to them. And it gives PZ and other critics the opportunity to say, you're upset over what happens to a cracker and not over your priests buggering little boys. Let's put things in perspective.
Yeah, the same day all of that was blowing up, I read in the newspaper that it was a headline that was literally like, Pope considering apology for Catholic priests.
Yeah.
Like, seriously?
Whatever happened to the old adage, turn the other cheek, and all these other...
Rebecca, what's the Pope doing? Is he sitting there like, should I apologize? I mean, was it
right,
dead
exactly.
enough?
He's like, well, once we deal with this cracker kerfuffle, maybe then I'll give some thought to that. Yeah. And one of the funny things that strikes me in the turn the other cheek category is that a lot of the people emailing PZ were saying things like, you just say something like that about the Muslims and see what happens to you, and then we'll all be laughing. And it's basically, you know, I'm not going to kill you, but I will laugh when someone else does the dirty work for me. And it's like, you know, not much better.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in fairness, I think this is a rabid minority. You know, I don't think this is your rank and file.
Yeah, it definitely is.
But it talk about negative press. It's incredible.
To add a little detail into the death threat that PZ received, the email gave him until the first of the month to resign his position at the university, or the email said, you have two choices. You can quit your job for the good of the children, or you can get your brains beat in. That's a Christian.
Right.
That was just one of them. Yeah.
For the good of the children. It's always about the children. Let's go on to the next news item. Now, you guys know I love the Discovery Institute's blog, Evolution News and Views.
You should write for that.
Yeah. We're going to have an intervention one of these days.
Yeah, I know. But this one was so stupid, I couldn't stay away. Mm-hmm. So Casey Luskin, who's one of the more mindless bloggers over there. This is the Discovery Institute propaganda blog.
It's like being the skinniest kid at fat camp. Oh, wait, mindless? Oh, never mind. That's actually kind of impressive.
So she's the fat kid at fat camp.
Being the fattest kid at fat camp.
You guys remember Tiktaalik? Tiktaalik was the fossil that was discovered that is a link between fish and tetrapods. So it's a missing link. It's an actual missing link. Of course, you know, you have a beautiful transitional fossil like this. It's a slam dunk for evolution. And I think we mentioned before that not only is this a beautiful transitionary fossil, it was found by paleontologists who went looking for it in a specific strata because they hypothesized that this kind of fossil had to exist at this time period, right? It had to exist during a time when fish were evolving into tetrapods, and they found it. It would talk about a predictive power of evolution, right?
What did he say specifically, though? What needs to exist in this time frame? What was it?
It was a fish basically with fins evolving into feet, okay. Right? Yep. And so they found exactly what they were looking for. The propagandists over at the Discovery Institute, you know, have to do whatever they can just to throw doubt onto this specimen, right? So they're in a tough position. They have to make arguments that are more ridiculous than they usually have to make because this is such a nice example of a transitional fossil. So here's Casey quoting Shubin from the article. The Intermedium and Ulnari of Tiktaalik have homologs to eponymous wrist bones of tetrapods with which they share similar positions and articular relations. Now, Casey Luskin writes in his blog, translation, okay, then exactly which wrist bones of tetrapods are Tiktaalik's bones homologous to? Shubin doesn't say. This is a technical scientific paper, so a few corresponding wrist bone names from tetrapods would seem appropriate, but Shubin never gives any. So this was Luskin really just flaunting his ignorance for the world to see. Now, I wouldn't expect everyone to know what the word eponymous means. The only reason why I know it is because I encounter it every now and then in the technical literature. It's not a word that I don't think I've ever used in conversation.
It's the title of an REM album.
Is that right?
Yep.
It's also part of the word
but hippopotamus. Eponymous means, yeah, it means by the same name, right? So when Shubin is saying that the Ulnari has a homolog to an eponymous wrist bone in a tetrapod, he means that it's homologous to the Ulnari of a tetrapod. He's giving the names in a very efficient way by just saying it's evolutionarily derived from bones that have the same name in the tetrapod wrist, right? So the wrist bones in the fish have the same name as the wrist bones in the tetrapod, and they actually, you know, the tetrapod bones actually evolved from the bones of the same name in Tiktaalik in the fish. There you go. Luskin didn't even bother to look the word up.
So he's translating like a technical sentence, wow. And he messes up on the only word that really wasn't technical, just a little obscure.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. He blew it on language. Forget about understanding the actual evolution of scientific arguments. But it just shows you how intellectually sloppy they are. They're not trying to understand what's really going on. They're just trying to cast as much doubt on this. They're just trying to say, oh, look, Shubin is being vague and not describing technically what he's talking about, as if there's some deception going on, when the reality is that Luskin is just a stupid idiot.
Luskin's a white hole.
Seriously, I mean, the guy should be flipping pancakes at IHOP, I tell you. I mean, writing for a
hey, Steve, you know what? Maybe he is.
Maybe he is.
On my break at lunchtime, I'm going to write my news entry to the Discovery Institute. You know, get back quick, get some extra
rather eponymous of him.
Syrup over there. Okay, table five.
Oh, what a week. This is a hell of a week.
Well, let's move on to some actual science news to try to recover from the funniness. So, Bob, tell us about the new laser surgery technique.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. Engineers at the University of Texas at Austin have created surgical lasers so accurate that they can destroy single cells, leaving their neighbor cells unaffected. Mechanical engineering assistant professor Adela Ben-Yakar says that with the system they developed, you can remove a cell with high precision in 3D without damaging the cells above and below it. And you can see with the same precision what you are doing to guide your microsurgery. Now, what they use to do this is there's two parts that they use. They use a femtosecond laser and a powerful type of three-dimensional microscopy. Both of them are very interesting.
Femtosecond.
How small
is that?
I'm glad you asked that, Jay. A femtosecond is basically a quadrillionth of a second.
Okay, that doesn't help most of the listeners.
All right, well, I'll try to put it into some perspective. Take a billionth of a second. Now divide that into a million pieces.
Oh, my God.
How far would a light beam go in a femtosecond?
Aha, that's a good one, Steve.
4 foot
in
one.
In 1 second, in a little more than 1 second, light would travel, can get to the moon. In 50 femtoseconds, it travels about the width of a human hair. So wow. It's super, super tiny. So you're talking about a laser with these super short pulses.
Yeah, but Bob, what if you just turn that laser on and put it on somebody? That thing could...
It would completely take out one of your cells. Gone.
Whoa. No,
obliterated.
I'm thinking like a lightsaber. You know?
Now, the...
the femtoscale, it's like a lightsaber.
Yeah, turn it on for a few quadrillion femtoseconds, and now
there's a bacteria that's like,
OB bacteria?
One of the reasons, now they've used lasers in surgeries before, but the problem is that the laser gets so hot that there's damage all over the place. You know, it's on a small scale, but still, you're destroying all these cells that are around the sick cells. Basically, the femtosecond laser, the pulse is so brief that the transfer of heat is completely minimized. And actually, it's so hot, it gets so much hotter than boiling that it just turns a cell into like an ionized plasma that just kind of dissipates away. So that's one side of the coin. The other side of this breakthrough is this 3D imaging tool that these people are using. It's called two-photon fluorescence microscopy. Now, I went to a bunch of websites trying to get a real good definition of this, and it was actually difficult. Some of them were just so technical that it was hard for me to follow. But if I followed it, I think what they're doing is they're using two photons. They shoot two photons into molecules that absorb the photons, and then the way that this energy is released after the molecule get the electrons in the orbits get excited and they go back down and release the energy, they can kind of figure out, all right, where these cells or where these molecules are. And that way they build up this beautiful three-dimensional map of all the cells around them so that there's nothing, there's no extraneous information from these cells that are really far away kind of messing, confusing the targeting. You know what I mean? So that's pretty much what they're doing. Basically, it's a detailed three-dimensional map of the cells. So
Bob, how can they get that laser into a particular part of your body, say 3 or 4 inches down, or brain cells, or what do they do?
Well, what they're doing is that their ultimate goal, and they think they'll achieve this in a few years, is they're going to get this into an endoscope, into one nicely flexible endoscope that they can use for surgery. Right now, it's a little bit too big. It's about 3 times too big, but they think they can get it. They could shrink it enough.
Although it's only too big, if it's not too big to use as an endoscope, meaning you put a little camera where you want to go, and you have the imaging, and the laser is attached to the imaging, so you could basically zot what you see. The problem is that it's not compatible with existing endoscopic equipment.
Right.
So it's really just an issue of compatibility that they need to
make
it smaller.
But if you're going to make a new endoscope, you got to make it compatible pretty much with what's out there. I mean, so it's really not going to come to its own until it reaches that size. And you know how electronics and miniaturization is working. In a few years, they should be able to pull this off, and then you've really got something there. And if you don't know what endoscopy is, it's a new trend in surgery. Instead of one big nasty scar, like if they're taking out your kidney or whatever, it's like these three little scars. And our father recently had this surgery, and it's amazing. He's got these three little incisions, and recovery is really fast. And scarring, of course, is minimized because you just got these three little scars instead of one big one.
The instruments through one hole, camera through another hole, you know, things like that.
Right. I know some people are probably thinking, well, how effective is this going to be if you're just zapping one cell at a time? If you've got significant amount of surgery ahead of you. You can't just be zapping one cell at a time. But what the idea is, though, is that they've got imaging software that will allow surgeons to target one cell at a time using algorithms. They could also use this device to detect diseased cells and destroy them automatically. Now, stop thinking about those cosmetic lasers that run amok in Logan's Run. That's just a movie. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, but what about the instant healing bomb? They're going to come out with that next, too.
Yeah.
I get the instant healing going, too. From one point of view, it's just an ultra-precise endoscopic surgical laser, which in and of itself, you know, is a great advance. But if you get to the point where you combine it with the imaging and computer algorithms, that it could be, you know, look at a tissue at a microscopic scale and just zot all the cancer cells, for example, and leave the healthy cells alone, then you're talking.
Yeah, especially for something like if you're working in an area that's like your vocal cords, or brain cells, even more so, where you want to nail these cancer cells and you want to, you know, absolutely spare every healthy neuron, then you could see how important this would be.
So let's go on to a few emails. First email comes from Cam Steer in Melbourne, Australia, and he writes, "Hi guys, love the show. On podcast number 154, Dr. Adele brought up the point that many people, when asked what evidence would change their mind about a particular subject, are unable to answer, or state that no evidence would change their opinion. I was thinking about this in relation to my own beliefs, and to my dismay, I discovered that I might actually be the same as those people. I am an atheist, so I was wondering what kind of evidence would convince me that there was a God of some sort. My first thought was some proof that evolution couldn't happen by natural means, or that life could never have originated unaided. But truthfully, in that situation, I would just say that the science until then was wrong and wait for the next theory. Even if God himself or herself appeared before me, I would just put it down to some mental illness and seek professional help. So for fear of becoming as close-minded as the true believers, can you think of what kind of evidence would prove to you guys, and should prove to people like me, that evolution didn't happen, or that there is a creator God, or that homeopathy works, etc.? Any advice is appreciated. Keep up the good work." Well, that's an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. For me, it's like, what would it take for you to not believe in the theory of gravity? You know, mm-hmm. It's like, it's been established to such a degree that you really, it's like, almost, you know, disprove 2 + 2 = 4. It's a fact. So then to come up with another fact that you could encounter to disprove the first one, it's like, well, how do you do that without?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know,
I mean, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. I
think well said. That's what I was going to say.
It's easier. I came up with that by myself, by the way.
That's very pithy, very catchy.
Carl Sagan.
Thank you. No, it's Carl Sagan, but. Yeah, I think that, you know, and it depends on what claim you're talking about. If you're talking about if there's a God, well, that's kind of tricky because there's solid definition, you know.
There's no God test.
Right. But
there's
if you're talking
no
about homeopathy, that's easy enough. Just give me a couple of stringently peer-reviewed, successful trials that show it works. They don't have a single thing to show that it works. So even
they can't even tell two glasses of water apart which one was homeopathic and which one wasn't. They cannot statistically get past that, let alone if homeopathy works. Yeah, they can't even tell which glass is which.
The way it works is, you know, a study would come out and say, we found that we could tell the difference. This treatment worked, even if it goes against all logic. I'm cool with that. That's fine.
Like a good study. There are crappy studies which purport to tell that, like Rustam Roy's crappy research.
Well, no, that's
but it doesn't stand up to peer review. Is the problem.
That's what I was about to say. You know, you look at the study, and you know, and if that study is rigorous, then great. Does that mean I now believe all homeopathy? No, but it does mean that now we have something to work with. You know,
it's a step.
Now we can perfect that. Yeah, it's the first step. And so, yeah, I can totally see that sort of thing happening and convincing me, because even if right now we don't see how there's any way in hell anything as ridiculous as homeopathy could possibly work, if somebody could just show that it does work, that's really all I need.
Yeah, you're right, Rebecca, in that it's the question that is key. So Cam is mixing a few different kinds of questions here. And he actually hits upon why you can't ever have evidence for God, because as usually conceived of, it's a being that is outside the realm of the universe, not constrained by the physical laws of the universe. And there's just no way for us to have anything like scientific evidence for or against the existence of such an entity. What I would have always said is that, or if a being, a godlike being, appeared before me and said, you know, behold, I am the God Jehovah, worship me, how could I know that it wasn't just a really super advanced alien pretending to be a god, right? I couldn't know that.
Star Trek episode.
Yeah. I mean, so there are some questions that are not answerable by science. And those questions, there's no amount of evidence that could prove scientifically that it's true, because it's not a scientific question by definition.
What about evolution then?
That evolution did not happen. So the simple answer is you would need an amount of evidence that was at least equivalent to the amount of evidence that we have that says evolution did happen. Right, that's
which
all.
Is which is quite enormous. A bit.
Which is quite a bit, which is mountainous.
Extraordinary, to borrow a
homeopathy, term. I would like to see not one trial, not two trials. I want to see the same study show a clear effect, whatever that is, that you could tell the difference between homeopathic and non-homeopathic water, that there's some specific effect, and have it be replicable by any scientist in the world who follows the protocol, who does it the way they're supposed to do it, that it's absolutely an effect that you can count on, that's reproducible, and that does not go away when a real scientist does it, or somebody who doesn't believe in homeopathy
and
does it.
And a mechanism would be nice.
Right. Well, that would be a starting point. One here's an interesting story. I was lecturing about skepticism to the Warrens. You know, Ed and Lorraine Warren used to hold their classes where they would teach ghost hunting. Do you guys remember this?
Yeah, I remember.
And this is when we were in the phase where we were pretending to be friendly with them and we were investigating their methods and everything. And they invited me to give a lecture to their class. And one of the students in the ghost hunting class asked me, what would convince me, what piece of evidence would convince me that ghosts are real? And it was a hard question to answer in front of a hostile audience, but I was trying to say was that there is no single piece of evidence that can convince you of such a complicated phenomenon. Just like there's no single piece of evidence that proves that evolution happened. I said, first, the starting point would be a genuine anomaly. You know, give me something that I can't explain with existing, you know, explanatory methods, something that's a true anomaly. That's a starting point. And then we'll go from there. And then we could find out something about the nature of that anomaly, and that maybe it has some properties which people think of as, you know, ghost phenomenon. Something. But, you know, it takes a research program to slowly build a story to establish a new phenomenon, not just one piece of evidence.
Right.
But for things like that, for things like homeopathy or ghosts or whatever, the proponents are not even getting up to bat. They're not even getting up to that first step that you would use to launch into a research program, let alone establishing the reality of any of these things.
Plus, what standards are you going after? Like Joe Nichols says, there's no authentic paranormal activity. There's no authentic ghost photograph or ghost evidence. How do you go about measuring these things?
Yeah, there's no gold standard.
It's nearly an impossible task.
Yeah. Well, I mean, science discovers new things. You have to establish what the gold standard is, but you have to do it very, very carefully and meticulously by ruling everything else out. And, you know, you have to triangulate multiple different independent lines of evidence to say, yeah, this is what's going on. But again, they're so far away from that. They're just, you know, like we always throw out the term, oh, that's ghost cold. That's their science, right? You see that cold? That's ghost cold. That's what they're leaping from an alleged anomaly ghost to a cold. Conclusion and missing the 20 steps in between that science, where the science is.
Yeah, and most of the time, Steve, they're not even anomalies. You know, there's reflected lights on glass.
A draft.
There's, you know, a draft somewhere. Like we're not talking about anomalies. This is just things that they're superimposing these ideas on top of everyday events.
That's right. Yeah, that's what I say. Let's start with a real anomaly, and then we'll go from there.
So I was thinking about this person's email. I came to some of the same conclusions that you guys did, and I also thought of this. Things like gravity and evolution, exactly what you said, Steve. Like there would have to be that much evidence undoing all of the evidence that we have. And then I thought it's almost more. It would be more likely for me to actually believe in God than it would be to disbelieve or to stop believing in gravity or, you know, a concept like evolution.
I mean, there are some scientific truths that will likely never be overturned. Like, you know, DNA is the molecule that carries genetic inheritance information from one generation to the next. That's right. Never going to be overturned.
That's a good example, and that's how I see evolution. That the mechanisms will change, but the big E of evolution can never be undone. It would take. I was thinking, what would it actually take?
Well, how about this? It's possible. Let's say we find horse fossils in Cambrian strata, right? So 500 million years ago when there was nothing but little tiny multicellular animals around, and you see in that clearly embedded naturally in that strata, and not just one example, that could be some fluke mixing of layers or something, but you know, we find these all the time, a non-evolutionary fossil sequence, something that's just impossible. Then we would have to say, all right, there's something else going on here. Either, you know, there was alien interference in the course of evolution in the planet, or there's just something else going on that we're not accounting for, but we cannot account for that within standard evolutionary theory.
But
it's possible. We've never have found any of those anomalies or anything that would falsify the straightforward evolutionary story, but we could. It's not impossible if evolution were not true, or if there were something else going on too.
I know what it would take. You wake up and your entire life has been this virtual reality game, and you actually live in a reality where there is no fossil evidence and no evidence. It's just evidence that we appear. Like, okay,
we are in Shirley MacLaine territory.
Then I would buy that.
Yeah, but you would question that new reality.
Yeah, I would. But
that's the problem. You wake up in the Matrix. Now you will never know what's real.
Yeah, you could never know what's Principal real. Opened the door and there was Bobby, you know, Dallas, Seth Danning. It was all a dream. Right.
But it would take something at that scale, that level, to make me say, yep, it's not real. It's probably not real.
All I would conclude from that, Bob, is that I have no idea what's real, because if what we're experiencing right now isn't reality, and suddenly I find myself waking up into some other reality that's just as real as what I'm experiencing now, the only thing you could really conclude from that is you don't know. You can't know what's real.
Guys, what about believing in God or believing in the supernatural? Well, what would it take? Like, paint the scenario or start talking about that.
Well, I mean, it would be very tempting to leap to a supernatural conclusion if something very compelling happened, but you still have to keep your wits about you and realize that there could still be something very fantastical going on that still isn't supernatural. You know, like, again, you could generate an infinite number of hypotheses. Again, it could be an alien with some kind of mind control device playing, having fun with you, or maybe somebody invented a true holographic device and is doing pranks with it. I mean, as bizarre as any of those things sound,
you have to rule them out.
You still would have to rule them out before you could say, all right, this is supernatural or paranormal.
Or would it take bringing someone back from beyond?
Yeah,
the beyond.
You know? If Perry walked through the door right now, that would be extremely compelling because I saw him dead. You know, so that
the first thing you do would be to get yourself to the hospital to have your head examined.
Well, not if you're not alone. I'm just saying, like, under the circumstance where you're among people you trust and you experience the same thing,
Then I would check the carbon monoxide filter.
Right.
Yeah. First, you'd have to confirm that it's not just as Cam said, some kind of mental illness. You'd have to confirm that this is real, that this is, you know, this is confirmable. And then, even still, I would try not to prematurely narrow the possible things that could be going on by concluding this is something paranormal. For example, maybe somebody cloned him from some cells of his, or had whatever, somebody from the future, some alien, some amazing technology that somebody got access to somehow.
So what you're saying is anything grounded in the physical world, in physical reality, is more likely than jumping to
a
supernatural conclusion.
Always.
Right.
Always.
And you owe it to yourself to rule that stuff out first.
Yeah. Though, at least historically, those explanations are much more fruitful than the paranormal ones. So I would exhaustively pursue that before ever settling. Because I think settling on the paranormal explanation is just saying I give up. It's ending the process of investigation. Because you're saying it's not something that is scientifically knowable. It's supernatural. It's beyond laws that are amenable to science. So I always see that as giving up. And I wouldn't want to give up. I would want to know exactly what was going on. And that would mean considering any possible physical explanation for what you were experiencing.
Think how that would consume us, though.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think we'd miss a few podcasts, right?
And let's go on to our interview. We are sitting now with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's my first time on the program. Thanks for having me.
I've been dying to have you on our show for a long time, actually. And I knew that you were when I saw
so
you.
So why did it take so long?
Well, I saw you as a keynote speaker here.
You're a busy man.
I knew this would be the golden
I feel unloved.
How could you feel in love when you are the sexiest astrophysicist in the world?
Well, that was
right?
7 years ago.
Oh, well. I think
have you been dethroned, or are you still on?
Actually, they haven't repeated the category.
So there you go. I guess that means I'm still the reigning champ.
Yeah, you closed it up.
We had Carolyn Porco last year, I think. Mm-hmm. She's a hot little
colleague
member.
Of mine, yeah.
Yeah. But the vest you're wearing, I say, has to put you...
It's a little loud. This is my cosmic vest with bright sun and moon bursts on it. But I've grown accustomed to wearing it, and people, have grown accustomed to seeing it to the point where they even expect it. So I'm happy to wear it. Although, since it's thick cloth, we are in Las Vegas, where it's 105 degrees outside.
Yeah.
It's not really the right thing.
That's right. But
we should all have these conferences in bathing suits or something.
Next year in the pool.
Yeah, poolside lecture. Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
So, just for our listeners, Neil deGrasse Tyson is the director of the Hayden Planetarium.
But before I'm that, I'm actually just simply an astrophysicist.
An astrophysicist. Yeah. I was going to put that next.
Oh, sorry.
Author of several books. Which, why don't you go ahead and plug your books right now. Tell us about your books you've written on astrophysics.
Well, my most recent one, the one that's sort of most available and most widely read, actually, is Death by Black Hole, now available in paperback. And that one is 10 years collected of my most requested and my personal favorite essays that I've written for Natural History Magazine. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising that they could come together as a book, because normally it would just be piecemeal, but this one wasn't. There were enough essays that became chapters that had cross themes and resonance with other parts that it became a whole in ways that I didn't even anticipate beginning it. And the title chapter is a rather graphic description of what would happen to you as you descended into a black hole.
So the word spaghettification must be in there somewhere.
You know!
I know. I knew it. I just wanted to say that word.
You can't fall into a black hole and not be spaghettified.
Can we get the quick overview?
The quickie, black hole quickie, is as you stand here on Earth, you may know that the force law for gravity will tell you that Earth's force of gravity at your feet is slightly greater than at your head because your feet are closer to Earth's center. But that difference is not very much because you are short compared with the radius of the Earth. But a black hole is a very small object. Many of the ones we're talking about here are small. So that as you descend, there comes a point where your height is significant compared with the size of the black hole or the size of the event horizon of the black hole. And what that means is the gravity at your feet becomes incessantly greater than the gravity at your head. These are what's called the tidal forces, and you begin to stretch. Initially, it might even feel good. We all stretch in the morning, right? But it doesn't stop. And you reach a point where the tidal forces exceed the molecular forces that bind your flesh, and you basically snap into two pieces. Mm-hmm. And then those two pieces, as they descend, each feel their own growing tidal force, and they snap into two. So you go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16, till you're a stream of atoms descending down this abyss. And that's not even the worst of it. The fabric of space and time funnel down to a point so that as you descend, you're actually getting extruded through an ever-narrowing track through space and time, like toothpaste coming out of a tube. And so that process has been knighted being spaghettified.
So how long would it take? Do we have any idea if somebody did go in? Like, is it a second that it would take?
Depends on the size of the black hole.
Yeah, depends on the size of the black hole. It would take minutes, not seconds. You're falling great distances.
Yep.
Doesn't time slow down as you approach the center?
For other people
outside.
Watching you.
Okay.
But for you, you just fall straight in.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're only going to survive maybe 15, 20 seconds.
Well, I kept trying to invent some kind of rotisserie. Yeah. Right? Because if you're rotating fast, you're not going to stretch in one way that sustains. Mm-hmm. But I'm working on that.
Okay.
one thing at a time.
Yeah.
But what the point of the book is more than just... by the way, that chapter comes from a section called When the Universe Turns Bad, All the Ways the Cosmos Wants to Kill Us.
Yeah.
But what the book is really about is a celebration of science and how to ask questions about the universe and how we've come to learn what we know about the universe. And it's gotten I've gotten great feedback on it, which pleases me greatly, because when I wear my scientist educator hat, I'm, as opposed to just pure scientist hat, I value those comments in people, because it means that I'm doing the right thing, or at least what it is they want or expect.
I think that that's your role seems to be so important. I've seen you, you know, on the Daily Show, and you can transition from that to a more serious environment, and you do it so smoothly.
It's hard, but thanks for noticing that it's smooth, because it was hard to make it smooth.
Yeah.
That was effort. It's to go from Jon Stewart to Colbert to NBC News is the three completely different kind of encounters with somebody who's asking you questions. And so I have to come sort of preloaded. And I think it matters. You could do a little homework. At first, you look at previous episodes, look at the pace of the exchange of comments, and make a judgment as to what you can expect for yourself, given the content you're carrying to the table. I don't think enough people do that. Certainly not enough of my colleagues do it. And they might be taken aback or surprised by some line of questioning when they could have just done a little bit of homework. So I encourage my colleagues to do a little bit of that research before they enter.
How much were you influenced by Carl Sagan in that respect?
I was already shaped knowing what I wanted to do when I grew up. At the time I first met Carl Sagan, I was in high school. But my application to college at Cornell, little did I know, after I'd been accepted, it was forwarded to his office. And he wrote me a personal letter saying, I was like, is this the Carl Sagan that was on, like, Johnny Carson? It can't be. Is this a forgery?
You still have that letter, right?
Of course I still have that letter. And he said, I understand you've been accepted at Cornell. If you find it in your schedule to visit, let me know in advance. I'd be happy to meet you and show you around the
lab. So you were there the next day, right?
It was maybe 3 weeks later. I made the time, went up there, and sure enough, he met me outside the building, brought me in, and brought me to his office. And I never forget, he reached behind him and pulled out one of his books and signed it and handed it to me. And I said, but that is so cool. He's got like one of his books, like in arm's reach behind his desk. And and on my way home, at the end of the day, it started to snow. He took me to the drove me to the bus station. He said, if the bus can't make it through, here's my home phone. Call me. You can spend the night until the weather clears. And I thought to myself, I'm nobody. What's he doing this for me for? And to this day, I don't see the audience. I just banged the table. to this day, I treat students the way he treated me, because he had no prior reason to treat me as anything. But I somehow I matter to him. And I try to make sure that students matter to me because of that encounter. In that way, he was influential beyond measure.
So you have books behind your desk and you hand them out?
No, they come in and I pull out the books. That's exactly. And I think of that moment. I think of that moment.
We joked at the beginning about you being voted the sexiest astrophysicist. But after just listening to your keynote speech at TAM, which was awesome, by the way, which was, to me it was as entertaining as a stand-up comic, but a scientist who's also a stand-up comic or just a polished entertainer.
He said to me, I'm glad I'm not following him today.
I got a day. People will forget.
Actually, I'd like to distinguish myself from a stand-up comic in the following way.
Okay.
I will not hesitate at finding humor in the universe, but I don't go out of my way to tell a joke.
Yeah.
I didn't tell any jokes today, right? Oh, did you hear the one about that? No.
Yeah,
no, it was all flowed out of the content.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a lot of natural humor out there that gets overlooked because people somehow devalue it. But I think it makes you smile and it makes you remember.
Right. So what struck me was like, wow, this is a guy who knows how to make science sexy and how important that is in our culture. How conscious is that? How did you set out and say, I'm going to make science sexy for the public?
No, I am bringing science to the public the way I brought science to myself. That's all I'm doing. And it's what I saw in science that seduced me, and I'm gonna and that's what I'm doing with the public. And if it seduces them, I'm that's great. But I'm not. There's not. That's not a separate recipe.
Yeah.
That I'm bringing to the public that didn't come to me.
You're just doing what comes natural.
What feels right. I mean, I pay attention to whether people are paying attention to what I say. Did the eyebrows go up? Did their pupils dilate? Did they smile? Did they chuckle? And so I will select content that best serves that path of interest. And fortunately, I can do that and still be on the frontier of science. I'm not pulling things out of some box just to make you smile. We can talk about the search for life and the Big Bang and black holes and still smile and enjoy it. And these are frontiers. And so there's no lost tracking there.
Neil, what are you most excited about in science today?
I love the search for life. It's great. It's not even my background. I have no background in biology other than what I osmotically gather from my colleagues in astrobiology. But I think the search for life on Mars, on Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, with with a liquid ocean kept liquid beneath an ice sheet, liquid for a billion of years. You know, we've got every place there's liquid water on Earth, there's life of some kind, bacterial or otherwise. So the search for life, I'd like to think we find life in our lifetime.
Yeah.
And whether we find intelligent life is another criterion. Mm-hmm. But any life at all would excite biology and transform biology, actually.
Absolutely. About the ice on Mars that they just
exactly
that came out with,
that evaporated away on the Phoenix mission, but also the fact that we don't know what 96% of the universe is made of.
Yeah.
The dark matter, dark energy problem is a huge frontier, and it's fun to celebrate our ignorance because that's why we become scientists, to greet the ignorance at its doorstep.
What amazed me with that discovery was that in a very brief period of time, everything we thought we knew about the universe shrunk to 5% of reality. It's like, oh my God, there's 95%.
And of course, that's happened a half dozen times before.
Yeah.
But you think we'd get used to it by now.
Right.
You know, it's just another time where our ego gets messed over. You know?
you think, though, that, oh yeah, we're past that point, but we're not. We're not past it.
Because we're not in the middle of anything. We're not even made of the most common stuff. You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
To get back really quickly to your talk, what I found really cool about it was that I've known you as someone who promotes the beauty of science in a really great way. And what surprised me today is to see you come out like full force skeptic. Like, that was like a roller coaster through every pseudoscience. You just ripped it apart.
Well, yeah, I try, in the way only a few sentences could be enabled. But yeah, in this audience, I know it's a good audience and it's a skeptical audience and it's very resonant with what I do. So I had to make sure it was at least had hooks and links in ways that would matter. Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious to see what people – I think you evaluate the conference at the end. I'd be curious to see what people actually write about it. But I was sharing with the audience my life experience being a skeptic, and that was all it was.
It's something I have to mention. You mentioned one thing for your jury duty that just floored me because it was – it's a very funny story. You mentioned that during the voir dire process, when the Q&A, where you're being questioned by the various attorneys to see if you're suitable, you mentioned that you were, as an astrophysicist, you evaluate evidence, and I think you also mentioned evaluating eyewitness testimony and how bad it is.
And assessing the unreliability of eyewitness testimony. Yeah.
I've got a story that so parallel to that, I couldn't believe it. I was being voir dired, and they went through the preliminaries, and they said, Bob, what do you do on your spare time? Like, well, I'm a co-founder of the New England Skeptical Society. And what do you do for the society? Well, I'm actually writing an article for a newsletter about the fallibility of human memory. They said, thank you very much. I was on the street in 2 minutes. I was gone just like you. They didn't want anybody like that. It's funny.
So let me ask you, because I would get without saying similar questions. Is this your first talk, first of all, at a quote-unquote skeptical meeting?
Yes, completely.
And is this
first talk ever?
Is this your first sort of encounter with the label of skepticism? And had you
thought
about it
before? No, I'm a big supporter of the skeptics movement. I've been reading Skeptical Inquirer since 1980.
God, I didn't think I could love you more.
And I was so jazzed by it. Once I saw it, I went back and got all the back issues to 1974 or whenever it began.
The Zetetic.
I didn't know what that word means, but it was still cool. And so, you know, you read these, and what's amazing is how inventive pseudoscience people can be.
Absolutely.
You know, what's next? Oh, they're eviscerating cows. Okay, the aliens are, you know, and so it keeps me current, as it would keep all of us current. But I'm a huge supporter of that movement, and my personal goal is to get people thinking straight in the first place, so you don't have to sort of undo it later on.
Is there one pseudoscience that drives you crazy more than others?
No, they're all equally batty.
Yeah.
All of them. Yeah, I don't play favorites. They're all...
Yeah, that surprised me, too. I thought that, you know, you might focus more on the...
astrology, maybe.
Astrology, the moon hoaxes. Hoax, but, you hit up the
No, because they all are evidence of a faulty wiring in the brain.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's the wiring that has to be fixed. You can go and try to put Band-Aids on each one of these, but in the end, it's some... How do you think? Mm-hmm. And you fix that, and then I think all this goes with
it. So you don't just
it.
Treat the symptom, treat the
you
underlying
treat the cause.
Cause.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, my experience as a scientist, clinical scientist, and a skeptic is that you understand the science better when you understand all the ways in which it can go wrong.
That's another point. It's an undervalued aspect of this whole enterprise. So I do engage people when they write to me if I triggered their inquiry. If they just come out of the blue, I just don't have time. But if I wrote something or appeared on TV and that stimulated their interest, I will reply. I do engage them on their issues of religion and God and UFOs and all of this. But I do that sort of private between – it's a one-on-one, and I get to see how they are thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely valuable, just like you said, very useful in when you're conducting the very next argument that you do. So, in fact, right now I am gathering together my notes, my sort of archives, if you will, for a book that's on the very back burner called Letters from an Astrophysicist. And this is my correspondence with people who come to me puzzled about something that they either believe they understand or just simply don't understand.
Yeah. No, I agree. And other, I can't remember who it is now, but somebody else observed to me that a great way to teach science is to confront people's misconceptions about science.
Mm-hmm. And that's a way. I don't necessarily think it's the best way, but I think it's a way. You don't have to confront it. You should at least know that it exists so that you're not taken, you're not blindsided by a student's reaction to something that you say. Mm-hmm. You should be fully informed about all the tangled mental pathways that exist in your audience. But I don't necessarily espouse beginning your science class by bringing up hoaxes and things. I don't necessarily agree with that.
No, I agree. You got to lay the groundwork.
Yeah, because it's like the words come out of your mouth, and who knows what they remember 10 years later, except that you taught them about astrology in your astronomy class. You know, so I don't. I try to not give that much. Again, I'm working on how the brain is wired.
Yeah.
As the fundamental.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also find that scientists who engage to some degree in active skepticism, even if it's just within their field, are better scientists because it's almost like you look at a pathological condition that's really extreme, you learn about more subtle expressions of it.
So pathological is odd? Okay, I just want to keep the one-syllable versions of words available.
An astrophysicist, you remember.
Yeah, we are into one syllables.
Big bang.
So I need to remind you of that. So I agree.
Yeah. So bad disease. You study the really bad stuff. And then you could recognize the more subtle versions of it. So I think even mainstream scientists sometimes have little subtle pseudoscience.
And I get some of my skepticism from – I read old textbooks as how – and I see and probe how people thought about something that we now take for granted. Mm-hmm. And I see how they work through it and with great value to my modern thinking.
Your intention is to stay the director of the Hayden Planetarium? That's something that you see as part of your career going forward indefinitely?
Yeah, as long as I'm valuable to the institution. Otherwise, I'll just be a scientist somewhere. Yeah. I mean, that's all. I sort of recede back.
And how has that been a platform for you? How does that help you do what you want to do?
It started out as a platform because it's a visible institution. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened was the news broadcasters kept coming back because I was working on my sound bites that I was handing them, and they liked my sound bites. And so they just kept coming back, whether or not I was director, to the point where there have been a couple of interviews where they forgot to mention that I'm director, and that, you know, the folks back at the museum would rather the full museum gets the credit.
Yeah.
But there's been some transitioning of me being noticed for holding the title as director, and me being noticed because I'm serving their, I'm feeding their appetite for the cosmos, with or without the pedigree of a title. And in the end, titles shouldn't matter. What should matter is the integrity and the strength of your argument.
Right. And, you know, honestly, you're becoming your own brand. I mean...
Well, I try not to lead off, like I said, if you say, believe me, because I have this degree and I'm a PhD and I'm that and all the rest of that, if you have to lead your argument that way, you don't have an argument.
Yeah, not as an argument from authority, just that this is a cool guy who knows how to talk about science in an interesting and fun way.
I'd like to believe that by the time I'm done, you feel empowered with the information I gave you, so that you're not going to say, this is true because Tyson said it. You're going to say, this is true because I now understand it and now I can present that argument without reference back to me.
Right.
If you have to reference back to me, I didn't do my job.
Right, exactly. Teach people how to think, not what to think.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, it's really been a pleasure and an honor to sit here and talking with you. I wish we had an hour more. Maybe we'll rope you in the future for a follow-up.
Where do you guys record? Are you on the move all the time?
We're on the internet.
Yeah, we record over Skype, over the internet.
Oh, yeah, okay.
We can do that anytime you want.
Okay.
We'll,
We're on the East Coast.
We're in Connecticut.
Yeah,
so. In
Connecticut.
Yeah.
Connecticut.
Yeah. Well,
Connecticut.
You've heard of that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd like to, one last thing. Right now, yes. In press is my next book called The Pluto Files.
The Pluto Files. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, this is like odes, emails, and epitaphs in the name of a fallen planet.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So I have my like hate mail from third graders.
I thought it was just
put in there.
I thought maybe it would just be what you said at your talk. Pluto. Get over
yeah,
it.
Get over it.
It would be a short book if that was the case, but this is actually not me hitting you over the head. It's a display of society's reaction to this demotion.
That's interesting, yeah.
And from the point of view of children and colleagues and the press and humorists. Mm-hmm. And so it's a celebration of a reaction. And so that comes out in January.
Great.
So,
that's great. Yeah.
Well, awesome. Thanks again.
Thank you.
To be on. Thanks for having me.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you all at home could play along. All right, here we go. Item number one. Researchers have discovered a genetic variation that makes people of African descent more susceptible to HIV infection. Item number two. Using a new technique to measure the mass of black holes, astronomers have found that the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy is more than 1,000 times more massive than previously estimated. And item number three, in a newly published study, medical scientists predict that global warming will lead to more kidney stones. Evan, please go first.
Discovered a genetic variation that makes people of African descent more susceptible to HIV infection. That's kind of scary. The 1,000 times more massive than previously estimated for the center of our Milky Way galaxy, that seems almost too plausible to be correct, so I think there's a curveball there. Newly published study, medical scientists predict that global warming will lead to more kidney stones. The new technique to measure the mass of black holes. Well, I think that one's going to be fiction, Steve, and I'll venture a guess. There's something about the technique that is not quite right. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I think that's the key to that one. So I'll say that one is fiction. So there you go. Milky Way galaxy more than 1,000 times more massive than previously estimated. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Let's see. Okay, I think I'm going to agree with him because I don't think you would make up the one about there being a genetic variation that makes people of African descent more susceptible to HIV. I can certainly see that as being plausible. And global warming leading to more kidney stones is one of those things that sounds crazy at first, but then when you consider it, what we're talking about is a massive weather change. And when the weather changes, the things that we consume change. And it's the things that we consume that cause kidney stones. So, yeah, that seems true to me. However, the measuring the mass of the of black holes more than 1,000 times more massive, that's pretty massive. I'm going to say that is not true. You made that up.
Okay, Bob?
Let's see. The genetic variation that makes people of African descent more susceptible to HIV, that I'm not buying that. I think we're meant to assume that since the infection rate is just so huge in Africa that we might want to attribute it to something like that, but I think it's more of a cultural, political reasons than some sort of genetic difference. The third one, global warming and kidney stones, I could see some sort of weird, like what Rebecca said, some weird relationship between the weather and then food and then how many kidney stones people might have on average. So I'll say that is science. The second one, I could see that we possibly came up with an alternative way to measure the mass of black holes, but that we were off by three orders of magnitude. I'm not buying that. They might have refined it a bit, but I don't think we were off by that much. So I'm saying that the black hole one is fiction.
Alrighty, Jay?
Out of the three of them, the one I have the most questions about is the black hole one. Like, what? You say that it's the black hole is 1,000 times more massive than previously estimated. And one of my first questions is, how much bigger would the diameter of the black hole be if it's 1,000 times bigger? Right? So
I didn't say bigger. I said more massive. That's a very specific term.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. That does change that to me a little bit. The one about the kidney stones, yeah, I agree with Rebecca. Like, that just, or Bob, rather. I think that one is just kind of mundane. And there could be an explanation for it, and I didn't read about that, so I don't know. And then the researchers discovering the genetic variation that makes people of African descent more susceptible to HIV infection. That's a tricky one, too. I haven't heard anything about that. I don't know. There's something about the black hole one that seems off, so I'm going to take that as the fake.
So you all agree that the black hole one is the fake.
Mm-hmm. So I just wish you'd stop using such a racist term, Steve.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was kind of a theme this week.
I think you believe you
Can
mean
you
the
say
African-American
the
hole.
Non-light-emitting area of outer space?
Let's take these in order. First, number one, researchers have discovered a genetic variation that makes people of African descent more susceptible to HIV infection. That is science. There are lots of variability. There is lots of variability in the ability for HIV to infect various people based upon genetic variation. There are some people that are inherently extremely resistant to infection, or once infected, they become carriers but never really develop AIDS, and we don't know why. So it's not surprising at all that there would be genetic populations who would be more or less susceptible to infection. So, Bob, you're right. I think that, Africa, obviously there's an AIDS epidemic happening there, an HIV epidemic, and that's largely caused by political and sociological reasons, not this. This is just an extra little whammy thrown in there. Interestingly, the same mutation that confers increased susceptibility to infection also allows those infected to survive on average 2 years longer. So they get infected easier, but they survive a little bit longer, which means they're around longer to pass on the virus to.
Did you hear about the supposed Achilles heel of
yes,
that they found? Very interesting. There apparently there's one site on the antigen or that doesn't change. That can't mutate because that's the site it uses to bind to your cells. And if it mutated that, then it wouldn't be able to bind to the cell. Everything else can mutate, but not that little bit. And they think that if they target that little bit, they can just really fry it. So
Of the big problem with HIV is that it mutates within a host. So it actually becomes harder and harder to treat as the infection goes on. There are so-called hypervariable regions that can change very rapidly. But there's the stable regions that don't change as much because they're necessary for function, like binding to the T cells. That's an obvious target for therapies. So that one is science. You guys all got that one correct. This is research published in Cell Host and Microbe, co-authored by Robin Weiss from UCL Infection and Immunity. We'll take these in order. The next one is... Using a new technique to measure the mass of black holes, astronomers have found that the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy is more than 1,000 times more massive than previously estimated. You all thought this was fiction, and this was fiction. So you guys, two weeks in a row, you guys swept me.
Ran the table.
But this is based on a real study. Astronomers have developed a new technique for measuring the mass of black holes. Did you guys, any of you see this news item?
No,
actually. This was one I was hoping you see the headline. If you didn't read past the headline, you could have got suckered into this one.
Luckily for you, we're completely ignorant.
It's a personal choice.
The astronomers have developed a technique using the Chandra X-ray Observatory.
Love it.
Yep. Which what they do is they measure the peak and temperature of a hot gas in the center of the galaxy, and they use that as a way of estimating the mass of a supermassive black hole. They didn't do it in our own galaxy. They did it in NGC 4649, and it confirmed that the technique is valid because it came up with the same answer as the traditional technique that had been previously been used. So it didn't come up with a new number for this mass of the black hole. It came up with basically the same number as previous techniques. So that shows that this new method for weighing black holes is probably valid.
Maybe you should have said 100 times more massive.
I always have to debate with how it's got to be enough so that it's, to give you a chance of saying that that's implausible, but not so much that it's ridiculous. So I actually almost did go with 100. Then I said, nah, maybe that's not quite. Just 100 times, that's a little bit. I want to make it solidly wrong. But
that's what really did it for me, the 1,000. I think even 100 would have done it too. But
it's a hard judgment call.
Yeah.
But I'd rather make it, rather make it too easy than seem unfair. All of this means that in a newly published study, medical scientists predict that global warming will lead to more kidney stones is science. That's one of those things that, as you guys say, at first blush, you're like, huh? Global warming is getting blamed for everything. Now we're going to have more kidney stones because of global warming? But what they're extrapolating from, you're kind of right, although it's not food. It's just simply temperature. Increased temperature leads to more dehydration, and dehydration leads to kidney stones. So there is actually a so-called kidney stone belt. You heard of the Bible belt?
And somebody wears one of those?
There's a kidney stone belt, which is a temperature zone where there's higher risk for a dehydration, and there's people living in those latitudes, you have a lot more kidney stones. And that will extend farther north as temperatures rise. And they estimate that within the next 20 years or so, we may actually have millions of cases more kidney stones because the kidney stone belt is expanding north. This is a study published by urologists at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas.
And so, Steve, following that logic, then people that are from the Mediterranean, we have a higher chance of getting kidney stones.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's why that's what the whole point of the so-called kidney stone belt is. People in the Southeast do have more kidney stones because there are more risk for dehydration. So, kidney stones are essentially different minerals like calcium precipitating out in the urine in the kidneys, and you can prevent that from happening by keeping your kidneys flushed, keeping dilute urine flowing through the kidneys. So just by being well hydrated. I have a colleague, in fact, who has a genetic mutation where he's just very at risk for developing kidney stones, and he's had it several times. And he's got to just constantly drink and keep his pee very dilute in order to prevent them from forming.
Ouch.
Does he have a kidney stone belt?
The researchers predict that by 2050, higher temperatures will cause an additional 1.6 to 2.2 million kidney stone cases in the United States.
Well, we might even have nanotechnology by then, so no worries.
Right. So, the thing that's interesting is that I was also thinking when I was reading this is, but aren't there some diseases that you're at higher risk of because of the cold that there would be less of because of global warming?
Yeah.
That you're just talking about climate change. If the climate changes, you're going to get more of some things and less of some other things. I'm not taking the position that there's no problems with global warming over climate change. I'm just saying that if you're just looking at one disease where high temperatures are a risk factor, any disease where high temperatures are a risk factor is going to get worse as temperatures go up. But there are diseases where low temperatures are a risk factor.
Yeah, like one of them is called coccus shrincus.
That's true.
And that's widespread, especially in Canada. Especially around where Mike Lassell lives.
Shrinkage, for short. Well, Jay.
Bring us home, Jay.
Please tell us. Can you bring us home with a quote, babe?
Is it quote time already?
Indeed.
The time passes so quickly.
I found a Japanese proverb.
Okay.
So this means that the author is unknown on this one, and I like it. It's a good little quote, and the thing I like about it is that this quote shows you that even though time passes, people don't change. The quote is, "If you believe everything you read, you better not read." Japanese proverb!
Man.
Steve, I would like to invite our listeners to please vote for us on Dig. We're going up, and it is something that's important to me and probably nobody else, but just do it.
No, it's very important.
It is. It's good.
We do appreciate it when our listeners help spread the word by giving us kind reviews on YouTube, on iTunes, and voting for us on Dig and Technorati and all those other aggregators and podcast voting things. And the YouTube project is going very well. We have our third video up. This one was edited by Mike Lassell. It's the cell phone and brain cancer bit. That's the one that includes the whole utility belt versus fanny pack debate. Mike did a very funny job.
God.
We're getting some good feedback initially on that. And somebody pointed out that, obviously we're up to 2,500 or so views on the video, so we're getting there. But You can also, we have a channel, and you could subscribe to our channel. We already have 471 subscribers, and I really recommend that you do that, because that actually, we're actually ranked pretty high in terms of channel subscribers, so that's a way of getting us fairly prominent on YouTube, even though the absolute numbers of views are still lowish. So,
yeah, I mean, you can get to that link on our homepage, or you can also get a link to the 5x5 podcast on our homepage.
Yep.
I found it very difficult to search for our channel. Maybe I just don't know YouTube as well as I thought I did, but when I tried to search for our channel on there, I couldn't find it. So I don't know. Maybe we had to work on our tags for that.
I mean, it's youtube.com/user/theskepticsguide.
So, or you could just type that in.
Doesn't take a genius.
Or just click the button.
I wanted to just say that some of our listeners may have noticed that we occasionally have a secret word on the podcast. One listener guessed what it was last week, and so I said that the prize would be us saying his name on the air. So congratulations, Fly Like Daedalus. You got it. Last week's secret word was udder.
Udder.
Udder. Like a cow udder.
And we're not telling you what this week's was.
No.
No.
I think it was a black hole.
But if you want to guess, you can go on the SGU forums, which are linked from the Skeptics Guide homepage. You can go on the forums, and every episode gets its own little forum topic, and you can take your guess there.
I'd also like to real quick just give a general thank you to all the people who are donating time to helping us do the various projects that we're working on. The list is growing of people that that write in and say that they're willing to help, and that, you know, and we're using them, and it's great. We're getting a lot more done.
Yeah, we're like, there's so many projects we could be working on. You know, Jay and I have been working to make sure that we are keeping our volunteers busy, getting the most out of people who are, you know, kindly donating their talents, their skills, and their time to the skeptical community, that was always a goal when we first started the Nest. It's actually in our mission statement that we want to be a venue for skeptics to contribute to the skeptical movement. And actually with the SGU, that part of our mission statement is coming to fruition more than it ever has before. So if you feel like you want to contribute to this project, let us know. We will find a way to use you.
One more quick thing about the website. I added a anti-spam measure on the Contact Us page called CAPTCHA, where you have to type in the letters that you see in a image. And I did notice that we didn't get emails for a little while, and I tried to make the page a little easier to use or whatever. But if you are having problems sending us an email, or you've sent one recently and you don't think that we've received it, you could either try resending it or maybe leave a message on the message board to let us know, please.
Yeah, and we had to do that because we were literally getting hundreds of spam emails a day. We had to do it. Well, thanks everyone for joining me again.
Thanks.
This was an interesting week.
This was a joy.
Yeah, a lot of fun this week. A little bit of a different episode, I think, but I think it's fun.
Pure gold. Pure gold.
Pure gold.
Oh, I'm having a party. Boston Area Skeptics. On Monday, July 28th is the next Boston Skeptics in the Pub. And this is going to be a really special one. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be playing Skeptics Trivia. And you don't have to be a skeptic. You know, you can bring along your friends who aren't that into the skeptic thing. It's cool. There'll be a lot of different questions for different skill levels. And there will be prizes, and much fun shall be had. Info, as always, at bostonskeptics.com.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again, everyone. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.